Well, the story before us this morning is a famous one, the widow who shows us all what true generosity and sacrifice looks like. Yeah, indeed, a model to aspire to. I mean, just this week, in our planning for the upcoming year and some changes we're trying to make administratively, we were discussing the program that we use on the website for online giving, something that began a little bit before COVID, but we are grateful for now in the midst of COVID. And it just so happened that right after this meeting, I decided to look up the program that we use online and saw that not only did they sell a product, they had a blog of articles that went along with the product they sell. And of course, most of these articles had to do with church giving and finance. And lo and behold, our text this morning was one of the texts spoken of as a model for giving. Quote, church leaders, understand, preach, and experience the 14 financial principles in this overlooked and misunderstood moment from the life of Jesus. I mean, needless to say, I was intrigued. 14 principles and a sermon to write, this sounded like it was a good place to be. Some of these principles are the value of sacrifice, to publicly extol those who give sacrificially as a virtue. Remember that possessions will pass. Riches are shiny, but not important. Don't tell that to a poor person. But how can you be sacrificial in giving is a question you should always ask. How can you increase your tithe to the church? And remember, a lot of small gifts equal big gifts, and so forth. Well, seeing as today is our annual budget meeting, and we happen to land on this text, I would like to open with 14 points this morning. If one looks through this article, or many that are like it, or even through much of the history of exegesis on this text, they are themes that do end up getting preached time and time again. The sacrifice of giving, or what it looks like to be a sacrificial giver, or what great faith looks like in the midst of hard circumstances. But the question is that what is here in the text before us? Is that what we are to learn from this particular woman and the gift that she gives? Well, I want us to see it this morning under three headings: context, contrast, and condemnation. The context. You can't help but notice that the context of this particular story comes into is a little bit strange, to say the least. If you've been following with us for the past several weeks, you know that from the beginning of chapter 20 until now, Jesus has been engaged in nothing but controversy. So he has come in the triumphal entry. His first point of action as the newly proclaimed and hailed king is that he cleanses the temple, overturning the tables of the money changers, which gets him in no small amount of hot water. And so the people come asking him, the leadership of Israel comes asking him, by what authority do you do these things? And so Jesus, right at the beginning, is engaged in this controversy or in this argument with the chief priests and the elders of Israel. And once he's answered their question, he goes on to give them a parable saying that there's going to come a day when the owners of the vineyard are cast out because of what they do to the son who owns that vineyard. From there, we see that Jesus is sent spies from these same leaders because they want to undo him. They've had enough of him. And these spies come and ask, should we pay our taxes to Caesar or not? Once he's answered that question, you remember he engages with the Sadducees, where they want to know about this one bride who had, you know, seven different brothers in marriage. Whose wife will she be in the resurrection? And then Jesus, once he's praised by the scribes, they say, good answer, Master. He then gives another riddle about the son of David being greater than David, and then he says, beware of the scribes. They've got all sorts of things that are concerning about them. And so after this whole chapter of controversy with the religious leadership of Israel, Jesus happens to look up and say, you know, wow, would you look at that lady and how generous she is and how much she gives out of her lack of resource. And then immediately, oddly, moves on to teaching about the destruction of the temple. It's just this strange blip in all of these stories where where Christ is engaging with the leadership of Israel, telling them about the judgment they're going to incur, and in the midst of it, there's this, you know, one-off story about a woman and her gift. I mean, it is strange to say the least. And what is odder still is that both Mark and Luke use the exact same sequence of stories to precede the telling of the story of the widow and her two mites. Now, that might not sound like much to you. Of course, they tell in the same order because, you know, the Gospels are the same story. But if you've read through the Gospels, you know that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they rearrange the order of stories to serve whatever purpose they have in their larger narrative. That who is the gospel being preached to in their particular context will often dictate how they tell the story of Jesus and where they put particular aspects of his life in their gospel. It's not that they dehistoricize it, they just rearrange it, much like you tell your stories. The ones you tell your friends may be different than the ones, you know, that you tell your mom and dad. The order of events may be different if you want to keep driving the car or whatever. And so in Mark and Luke, in this particular story, give the exact same sequence of controversy after controversy. Those who approach Jesus, then the widow's two mites, and then into this long teaching about the temple and the destruction of the temple. And Jesus then, again, after flipping tables in the temple, after getting in these arguments with the leadership, telling them that they're about to get kicked out of the vineyard because of poor management, Jesus follows up by saying, you see, not one stone of the temple is going to be left upon the other. It will all be torn down. And in the midst of that, he just happens to look up and see this woman and says, you know, this is a wonderful time for me to stop and just speak about how generous this woman is before I proceed to tell you about the destruction that's coming upon the land. You know, he pretty much says, I'd like to take this moment to give you 14 principles of giving, which is what we're apparently supposed to get from this text. I mean, maybe he did that, but it sure seems unlikely when you're just reading the story as an attentive listener. In fact, Jesus doesn't say, consider her example at all. He never even says, go and do likewise. He doesn't even extol her as a woman of great faith. It's like you're waiting, or we read into this text all of these things that we're to gain from it, but Jesus doesn't say any of those things. He just notices what she's doing, and he speaks to the difference between her and others. Instead of pointing out the great faith that she has, he just points out a comparison and leaves that comparison uninterpreted, or seemingly so. He says, look, everyone else gives out of their abundance, meaning all these people come to the temple and they give, and when they go home, they still have. So yes, they're giving, but they're giving from a place of prosperity where they're not going to be impoverished in the giving, where she gives all that she has. That once she gives this gift, she has nothing else. This is the end of it all. She's giving her actual livelihood away. And so as an object of comparison, she is introduced. So let's look at what she's being contrasted with. If that's the context, notice the contrast. It's spelled out for us in the text, even if our chapter divisions in English do not serve us well. You know, the chapter divisions in the Bible are late additions. They are not there. Jesus didn't inspire them and tell you what numbers go where. And so men at some point in church history to help us find things, which I'm grateful they did. If you've read or read a Hebrew text without chapter divisions, you are very, very grateful for the Masoretes as well as those who went on later to do these things with the Latin texts and other and otherwise. But in our text, there's a really unfortunate break. Jesus says, beware of the scribes, and he gives a whole long list as to why to beware of them. And then it says, and as he looked up, we'd hear this other story, and for whatever reason, those who are making divisions divided that from one chapter to the next. But they are all of one cloth, as we will see. He says, beware of the scribes. Why? Because they have these outward displays of righteousness and prestige, right? They have these long flowing robes. You don't only see that they're holy or righteous by their clothing, you also see that they're men of dignity. They're to be honored and respected. And we see that then by how they're treated. They get honored in public, right? Everyone speaks well of them or calls them certain titles and names, you know, good doctor. And, you know, everyone sees them and knows that they're somebody and acknowledges that they're somebody, not in just what they say, but also then in how they're treated. They get the best seats at the synagogue, you know, whatever those may be, We're Americans, so maybe the best seats are in the rear now. You know, those get taken first usually. But then it was to sit in front of the Torah where it would be read before the whole synagogue. And there they would be, if you will, on display for everyone in the community, seeing these righteous men there worshiping with the people. And once they left worship, you'll notice if there was feasts that were being held, they would get the seat at the front of the table. They were always put in places of importance. And whether they were physically rich or not doesn't matter. They were honored in society and they reaped the benefits of that honor. You know how it is. It's like our politicians. You see their paycheck and you think they can't possibly be that rich, but somehow they get all of these extra benefits that go along with what looks like a meager paycheck. It somehow ends up ending in mansions and estates and investments that seem to perpetuate into several generations. But these scribes, whether they have a full bank account or not, their life is full, and they will always reap the benefits of being people who are in desirous positions, and they're honored as such. Well, in comparison to them, we have this widow who couldn't be more opposite. I mean, if you even look in our own day, if you just think about the realities of widowhood in general, without looking into the historical context, it's never easy to be a widow. I mean, statistically speaking, as hard as it is to talk about, it's a far more common plight than being a widower. You know, if we were to take stats, and I hate to be so depressing on a Sunday morning, it's the wives here who will continue being in here in worship in years to come, because the husbands typically, statistically, will pass first. And of course, that's not universally the case, but in reality, that is the statistic. And we know, even in just normal society, how hard that can be if a widow has not been properly cared for or prepared for. It becomes then something that either, you know, the children will need to manage if they weren't cared for financially, or the government or the church, someone has to step in. But even just the relational problem, you know, the loneliness. You hope, right, as you age with this person you've known your whole life and who's known you. And then to have that ripped out of your world is a very difficult reality to bear in mind, not even to mention all of then the physical and financial realities that come with it. You know, all of a sudden, are you sure that you will be maintaining the home, you will be maintaining the vehicles, and all that comes with no longer having this relational protection. But of course, in this day and age, it's even more troubling. She does not have the comfort of a husband, nor the honor and the safety that comes with having one in this kind of society. She is a woman, and in that sense, she is not regarded in the same light as a man is regarded in this particular time period. She has no clout, no vote, no right to hold property, no power, both in government or in the community. And clearly in our text, she is poor. And that's not uncommon. I mean, this is in an agrarian society. When you lose the one who's providing for the household, you will need another man to care for you. There is no social safety net other than your family and hopefully the community beyond your family. It is the goodwill of those who are around you. And so once her husband has died, she has no means of income unless she has a son who's willing to care for her. If she has no son, she is in a very desperate situation, hoping that the community themselves will rally to serve her. And it seems our widow is on her own, mainly because of how Luke describes what she's done. She is given, says, these two copper coins, two lepta, and it says in giving them, then she's given all the money she has. The way that the Greek is translated, she gave away her life, her bios, or what we would call her livelihood, that once she gives this away, she has no more. And two lepta, that doesn't translate well in our day, but it's 1/64 of a denarii, which is one day's labor. So it's about $3. Two leptas on a good day is $3 if the dollar's doing well, you know. If it's not doing well, it's about $1.50. And in giving away her $3, she no longer has any money to her name. So obviously, she wasn't in a very good financial situation if this is all she has left to give. She couldn't be more opposite from the scribes. I mean, no power, no wealth, no prestige, no honor. So why here? I mean, why are we being introduced to her now, and what does this have to do with anything? Well, our final point this morning, don't get too excited, but it is our final point, the condemnation. Notice Jesus warns the disciples immediately preceding this text, beware of the scribes. But notice, it isn't just a warning. He's not just saying, don't be like them, they're bad. He's saying, don't be like them because they're condemned. They're coming under God's judgment. They have the greatest condemnation. And if you want to avoid that fate, don't be like the scribes. Immediately after he says these words, Jesus looks up, and what does he see? Two things: the rich putting in their gifts, and also a widow putting in the last $3 to her name. And right there is the problem, if we can see it. I mean, why are the scribes condemned? He tells us in verse 47, they devour widows' houses, and for a show they make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely. And as soon as he speaks those words, he looks up and he sees a poor widow putting in her last dollars into the church's offering basket. And he says, that's interesting. These people gave out of their excess. She just gave away her whole livelihood. And then apparently Jesus is saying, you know, my, what big faith you have. Let's talk about 14 principles for giving. I mean, is that what's really going on here? Let me tell you a story. It's a true one, a modern-day true parable. A lesser-known televangelist, Todd Kuntz, had what this particular writer of an article called a well-worn routine. Dressed up in a suit, pulls out a Bible, and he urges people on late-night TV to pledge a very specific amount of money, urging them, don't delay, don't delay. It sounds simply, this man writes, absurdly so, but Kuntz knows his audience extremely well. He broadcasts on Christian cable channels, often late into the night, drawing in viewers who lack financial literacy and are desperate for change. Quote, I understand the laws that govern insurance, stocks, and bonds, and all that is involved with Wall Street, he once said, looking directly into the camera. God has called me as a financial deliverer. Crucially, he always refers to the money that people are giving as seed, a $273 seed, a $333 seed, a turnaround seed, depending on what broadcast he's on. And of course, if viewers plant one, the amount will come back to them multiplied. It is an investment in their faith and in their future. Well, in 2011, one of those desperate viewers named Larry Fardet, then based in California, watched a lot of similar televangelists known as prosperity preachers who explicitly link wealth and religion, but he found Kuntz particularly compelling. Kuntz assured quick returns. He seemed like a results man, and Larry needed some fast results. The Fardet family was going through a tough time. His daughter was seriously ill, and he had health problems of his own. His construction business was struggling, and to make matters worse, both his van and car broke down irreparably within the same week. When a local junkyard offered him $600 for his van, he thumbed the bills thoughtfully and considered Kuntz's rousing speech. Maybe he should invest this sum as seed. He instantly recalled the specific numbers that Kuntz had repeated again and again, 273. It was a figure the preacher had often used. God gave me the single greatest miracle of my lifetime, and one day, the numbers, 2, 7, and 3, were all involved, Kuntz once preached. Larry has now come to realize there was no foundation to these promises, but these promises that donated cash would somehow multiply. But at the same time, the stirring speeches gave him hope. He did not see any other way out. So he sent off two checks. one for $273, and the other for $333 as requested. Then, out of money, he waited for his miracle. What would you say if I told you that story and said, this man has great faith. We should learn some very practical principles about giving and how sacrificial giving and great faith leads to great returns. I mean, did the man have faith? Yes, in one sense, of course, but misplaced faith. Did he sacrifice? He sure did. But what's your gut feeling when you hear the story? How do you feel about this particular preacher? Outrage? Maybe anger? I mean, the most telling part of the article is years later, as this man's daughter was on death's door, he reached out to this particular ministry and asked if they might be able to help him with hospital bills, to which they replied, that is not part of our charter, and if we were to help one person, we would have to help everyone. So how do you feel now? I mean, maybe mad enough to go find that faith preacher's church and tear it down brick by brick, which is exactly what Jesus is saying in this text. He's sitting there after saying, watch out for the scribes, their condemnation is going to be great. They devour widows' houses. To then having them sit back and watch as this widow gives away her last $3. And the very next thing that Jesus says is, not one stone of this temple is going to be left on top of the other until they are all thrown down. How is it that she, the most vulnerable person among them in their society, was left just giving away her very life while everyone stands around and watches? When the scribes are content to act as if it isn't happening because they have a luncheon to attend where they'll be receiving the humanitarian plaque for service to the community, their condemnation, biblically speaking, will indeed be just. You see, in God's economy, in both the Old and New Testament, to sit back while the orphan and the widow get trampled on and simply do church or receive accolades is not acceptable behavior. I mean, one of the requirements of being blessed financially in the New Testament, not a way to get financially blessed, but if you are financially blessed, God says, well, great, you owe something now. And whether you know it or not, most of you are financially blessed, myself included. I think a lot of times we think of the rich as the people who have just a little bit more than us or the people who have a lot more than us. But of course, statistically speaking, most of us are pretty wealthy on a worldwide scale. And according to the Scripture, we have responsibilities. Paul says to the rich, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds. Command them to be generous and willing to share. Chesterton got it right in seeing these verses when he said, the honest poor can sometimes forget poverty, but the honest rich can never forget it. Meaning that if you're rich, you have an obligation to be concerned about those around you that are in need. That it is an onus that is on us as those who have been bought at a price. Luther says, if you're rich and you see your neighbor is poor, then serve him with your possessions. Notice, not with your words or your well wishes, but to give to them. And see, one of the things that brought about the judgment in Israel in the Old Testament, one of the things that is made plain over and over and again is that sin, when it had reached the high water mark, one of the telltale signs were that widows in Israel were being neglected. How do you know when you've completely subverted society to where God is no longer honored or known, when those who are aged, who should be respected and treated with dignity, are put out to pasture and treated as if they are an interference or something that is an obligation and a drain on our resources that could be going to better things, like another vacation or a shinier car or whatever? Even as we read this morning in Isaiah 10, woe to those who decree iniquitous decrees. Woe to those who turn aside the needy from justice and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be their spoil. What will you do on the day of punishment? What will you do in the ruin that that will come from afar. I mean, if those were God's threats in the Old Testament, when God comes in human flesh, and these leaders for chapters now have been arguing about with him about, you know, why he's not doing it the right way, challenging his identity, and as he looks up and he sees what Israel has come to, these people who could care less about binding burdens on people that they are not willing to bear and who are willing to look aside as the needy among them are treated spitefully, Jesus looks up and he says, it's just a matter of time. You know how the prophecy goes. You keep doing these things and your day of judgment is near. That is why the very next text has these words. You see this temple? Not stone, one stone will be left on top of the other that will not be thrown down. You see, Jesus' words are comparative. This one came out of her poverty, and by doing so, she ended up giving up her very life or her livelihood. But he does not then go on to say, good for her, or go and do likewise, or how amazing is her faith. Rather, he is saying, how is it that this woman is surrounded by a society that is able to put in plenty, to declare that they have the temple and the word of God, they give and they go home to abundance and they sit back and watch while someone is impoverished in their midst who is in great need and don't lift a finger to help? What sort of religion looks at the weakest among them and says, become weaker still and we will pretend it is in the name of God as you do so? But that is the problem, of course, with all false religion. It requires of the participant what they cannot afford to give. It asks the poor guy with $600 left to his name to hand it over and get nothing back in return. It asks the widow to keep on giving until it hurts. It asks the lame to get up and walk and gives them no power to do so, the weak to become strong, those who are sinful and morally corrupt to make themselves better before they come in. It frankly asks dead men to make themselves alive. But the glory of the gospel that this Christ comes to preach is that this Christ who sees this woman's poverty is not only disgusted by the neglect, but he will enter into her poverty, giving away his very life in order that she will finally experience the riches and blessing of God, whether in this life or in the life to come. This Christ who becomes poor that we might become rich does not ask us to do what we cannot do, but rather calls us to admit that we have no power, we have nothing to give, we have no riches or honor that is ours, and to fall at his feet. And this one who has everything will stoop down and he will give and give and give until he has nothing left, and we are made rich in his poverty. I mean, Jesus watches this episode not as a disinterested observer, but one who is disgusted, knowing not just that judgment is coming to Israel, but that for her sake, judgment will come to him in order that he might lift her up and give her a life that she does not know presently in this world, and give her riches that will never cease. And because we, like her, have received so freely, what manner of people ought we to be? See, Jesus isn't here to teach a bunch of principles. He's here to give his life away. And those who have freely received from that gracious gift, how can we not look around with eyes that are open to say, how might I freely give with the abundance that's been given to me? May we do so as those who have been given grace hilariously from our Savior. May we also go and be gracious givers in return. Let us pray.